It's been 1, 2, maybe 3 weeks since the previous lecture, but if you remember, all of this is about me trying to write something on the idea that a trend in academic study of religion at the moment is focused on external manifestations, like behavior, like social manifestations, like physical manifestations. There's a great strain on stress on the body, for instance, and that this has reflected a certain reluctance to talk about internal experience, personal experience, subjectivity, the private dimension, the inner dimension, interiority. All of these kinds of things have gotten a little bit lost. And I think this is a shame, and also that it's a methodological problem for the whole subject, and also I think it's a problem of motivation. So people have lost a big part of what interested them in the first place if you take those things out of the equation. And I've argued that this is partly due to methodological flaws in the subject at the moment, that if you haven't got more coherent and honest methodologies for how to talk about the interior person, then of course the discipline's always going to gravitate away from that, because everything that you say about it is going to be fundamentally destabilized at the epistemological roots. So actually we have to do something about that. And I talked in the last lecture about anthropological approaches, and in that lecture, if you remember, I argued basically that empathy, if empathy is one of the major ways to try and talk about what's going on inside the other religious person, and many anthropologists will agree that you have to talk about what's going on inside the other religious person in order to talk about the meaning of what they're doing. I mean, I was just reading Levi-Strauss, and he tries to pretend that you don't have to talk about interiority to talk about meaning, but from Clifford Geertz and other people, by and large, people think you kind of do. Otherwise, you just describe structures but with no meanings to them, and it's not an explanation, not what most people mean by an explanation. And in that context, empathy, of course, is very much a problematic methodology. You can't just jump into another man's moccasins, as Ninian Smart suggested. But I argue that if you take Ricoeur and other modern thinkers seriously, what you're doing in empathy is not actually jumping into another person's subjectivity. What you're really doing is transforming your own subjectivity so that it will, in fact, it will never be exactly like the other person's, but it will become analogically similar enough that I can see in some deep ways where that person is coming from. And I've argued that that's a big part of why, for instance, literary evocation is a big part of anthropological method. And also why, if you look at what anthropologists write, there's some beautiful instances of characters writing about how they themselves have been just transformed. I was reading Paul Stoller, who writes a lot about this year he just published his autobiography, which is called The Power of the Between, but where he talks about going into other cultures and having to acknowledge that he'd left his own in some deep sense, and that his own self, his own personal views, had been totally transformed, and that it took him 20 years to find a way to even acknowledge this, because the anthropological discipline was so determined by a drive towards kind of clarity and epistemological certainty and a kind of neutrality and objectivity that at last now it's possible to say was never really possible or there in the first place. So it's a great, great book. It's an enjoyable read as well. Lots about a whole chapter entitled Sorcery, about getting lost in the magical practices of sorcerers in Nigeria.
What's the name of the person?
His name is Paul Stoller, Stoller. The book The Power of the Between. I mean, it's kind of interesting because Evans Pritchard wrote that he ended up feeling like he was living in two different worlds. Samuel Heilman is a Jewish anthropologist who says, well, sometimes I'm totally secular academic, and then I go in to study my Jewish community, and actually I'm a believing Jew, and my identity is really both. And you get all these characters who talk about, with magic particularly, people having their ideas of what's truth changed, and they have to decide whether this is terrible and disastrous and scary, in fact, there's a lot of fear involved, or whether in fact it's okay and indeed valid academically. And in the end of that, I tried to argue for a more flexible notion of the self, which the idea of which I myself am quite fond. Okay, so today I want to look a little bit more at psychology and its approach to religious subjectivity. I've called the lecture Psychology of Religion, the Cartography of Belief. And that's partly because I want to suggest as a whole in this lecture that what psychology is doing is not clearly seeing and describing mechanisms and forces that it is able to empirically immediately discern in the person. It's making a map, and if you think about the nature of a map is a symbolic chart of certain things that you will encounter under certain circumstances. Here you will run into, you see a blue line, and you know that if you get there in some form, you will encounter water. You see various different symbols, you know that in some form you'll encounter certain things. But a map is not, it's an assertion of, it's a prediction of certain encounters that you would have. It's not quite the same thing as a truth assertion about what is ontologically there. And I want to focus on the notion of models of things that are not automatically making truth assertions about what is going on in that space. And I wrote, I think, in the introductory rubric to this, psychologists of religion have produced speculative models of religious subjectivity according to which the human mind appears variously. And I say speculative models, that's the map idea. According to which the human mind appears variously as an ocean of symbols, a volcanic core racked by powerful forces, a computational machine, or a shell through which transcendence may occasionally break. And I would argue that just as science posits its own models, so psychologists of religion use metaphors of spatial relations, fluid dynamics, etc., to provide a mapping of the self, but that self is ultimately a hidden territory. And if you look closer at people like Jung and Freud, who are seen as being too kind of hardily assertive about their findings, actually they are quite willing to acknowledge that, like all scientists actually, they are simply proposing a speculative model, which may or may not be wrong, which has to be tested, which is flexible and fluid. It's just that when we read them, we sometimes forget that. And I also want to look at the way in which these thinkers incorporate kind of unmappable territories. What do you do if you have to acknowledge that ultimately you don't know what's in the mind for various methodological reasons necessarily? If they're right, then for instance the unconscious cannot be immediately discerned by the conscious mind, your own or anyone else's. So how do you incorporate that space into your map, especially given that it's actually seen by most of the thinkers to be central and in some sense a source for the forces that they're mapping? Okay, so just as by way of introduction, approaches to religious subjectivity in the psychology of religion, looking at methodological hopes and flaws. In many respects, the psychology of religion has an ambiguous relationship with its object of study. Okay. Since the business of defining, deducing, and expressing interior states is its stock in trade, that seems to be what psychology does, the difficulty of finding methods that will enable it to achieve this task is particularly central to the discipline. One ought to expect that psychology would be the place where people have developed the very best methods for talking about subjectivity. And indeed, there are many methods, from statistical analyses of religious actions or religious accounts to in-depth case studies of individuals and communities, from individual to corporate approaches, from the reading of social signs in action and language, to the reading of bodily signs through neurology, from the texts of psychiatric discussions to those of cultural products, from intellectual history to experimental innovation, from subjects in a state of well-being to those in a state of crisis, that all these different, very divergent ways of approaching it, the psychology of religion has become a very protean discipline. It adopts a wide range of different forms and approaches to try and capture its slippery subject. Its scholars are some of the most methodologically creative members of the academic study of religion's field, I think, and their resulting insights can seem by turns axially illuminating and at the same time strangely meager. I was just reading Pascal Boyer, and you read through his reasoning, you think, wow, this is amazing, he's shown us all of this material that's going on behind our thoughts, and yet at the end you kind of think, has he really shown it something seems, there seems to be something lost or lacking in the movement from the supposed evidence to the results that he's produced. And indeed, even though it would seem to be so clear and strong in its evidential material, his theory and many similar theories do not in the end get turn out to be adopted wholesale. I mean, actually, Freud's model has been. And that's interesting, given how weak much of his material is on an evidential basis. Okay, so there's much optimism. On the one hand, then, the empirical optimism of much experimental and social psychology of religion is attested in the confident tables of data which are duly produced. Statistical information gathered by heirs of William James's empirical, broad-brush, systematic approach may cross-reference surveys of religious claims, experiential descriptors, and personality features, and other material in order to paint increasingly minute pictures of religious communities. But we have all this material, all these different approaches, and a great deal of optimism and creativity, but there are methodological problems from the outset. So, for instance, Andrew Greeley in 1975 did this classic survey of different people's religious views. But the neat tick boxes of questionnaires on Andrew Greeley's survey, or the relativistic subjectivism of accounts given in more open interviews, all provide information that is at once fascinating and question-begging. How do researchers form the questions and categories used in their inquiries, and how do those preconditions shape the data produced? What relation do such broad analogical designations, or indeed any account using the more or less limited vocabulary for expressing perception and feeling about religion in any language, how do these things bear to the actual experience which they're supposed to represent? It's funny to read a lot of these surveys because you think, I had this my own experience in trying to do interviews with people on religion. How can you ask somebody, how can you find out what they believe? How can you, when you can't formulate the question very clearly because the vocabulary for talking about religion is a huge mess, and when the other person can't express themselves clearly, it's a great difficulty. I mean, the whole culture is riddled with the difficulty of actually mediating any kind of emotional or whatever we mean by the word spiritual concern, and to do that in a kind of a precise way is not an easy thing. Even as such approaches were developed, critics noticed that while these studies have much to say about the religio-social demographic of the times and places in which they were done, they also have a tendency to confusingly combine and conflate key questions of Western modern religiosity, while neglecting deeper questions about the definition of the terms. Okay. As a result, greater sophistication was developed. In order to help answer some of these questions, the discipline has developed very sophisticated tools for analysing subconscious and subterranean patterns in the language used to describe such states. Of course, one ends up asking, well, why do I choose that particular item of vocabulary? Why did that person respond with this particular theological set of references? What's going on in the very process of producing these explanations and descriptions? The subject's also become extremely self-aware in its process of choosing such descriptors, carefully consulting the existing cultural lexicon and its connotations. It often seeks to refine the x-axis of religious ideas by interrogating it with a y-axis, measuring the intensity of engagement with those ideas or experiences. So, for instance, you have to measure many different factors, not only the concept, the intensity of concern, the range of connotations, etc. Neurological models can be usefully mapped against other more oblique factors, such as cultural context, behavioral disposition, linguistic accounts, and the written or enacted text of the religious tradition itself, thus providing illuminating juxtapositions that cumulatively combat the flaws of each approach. Indeed, the discipline as a whole can be seen as a collaborative project building a cumulative picture of the many aspects of religious experience. You see this in Boyer again, just one example of a recent character. And of course, he's part psychology, part anthropology, but he uses anthropological material, he uses developmental psychology, he uses experimental psychology, he uses neurological psychology, and he mixes it all together. As a result, the psychology of religion continues to move toward increasingly complex accounts. For example, of religious belief as metaphysical claim, ethical judgment, paranormal credence, susceptibility to charismatic suggestion, quality of sensory perception, emotional feeling or mood, interpretive framework, distinctive experience, etc., 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 etc. It's a field which earnestly struggles in practical ways that maintain a healthy engagement with actuality toward a methodological maturity. It's an important thing that the actuality, the reality of what's involved in religion is something that, in theory, psychology of religion has to keep encountering in its experimental side. And so it has that necessity to deal with the facts has helped it to try and mature, I think, over time. It can't simply stick with a set model and dig itself deeper into the same methodological flaws. The collected wisdom of the psychologist of religion with regard to religious subjectivity is considerable. However, the deeper problem that remains is the problem of, as it were, the sign and the hidden signified. So on the other hand, one still feels strongly the danger of taking the external sign of the filled form, the personal statement, or the physical response as a replacement for the qualitative experience to which it, as a sign, points. I mean, this gets into questions of qualia, and I'm not going to go into this in great detail. But what I say about my feeling isn't the same thing as my feeling. That's certainly true for me. James Fowler's Piaget-inspired developmental schematization of the types of religious faith at different stages of the life of middle-class Americans is incredibly suggestive. So he talks to children, teenagers, middle-aged people, sort of older members of the family, and sees what each one has to say. But its typological generalization into categories such as intuitive projective, that's younger, mythic and literal, synthetic and conventional, individuative and reflective, he produces the typologies of ways to do religion, involves question-begging concepts circumscribed by distinctly Christocentric terminology. Psychological analysis of the process involved in arriving at experimental descriptors is necessary to underpin their application to the populations under examination. There's always a hidden dimension of interpretative bias, and this is something, of course, we see throughout the human sciences. So at every stage, there's a methodological blow to psychology's confidence. At every stage, there are subjectivities involved, both in doing the experiment, in designing the experiment, in interpreting the experiment, and in, of course, the subject who's giving you the data. And that means there are always hidden factors. How do we take the sign as a sign of the signified? In fact, Andrew Greeley's early studies, quite wise, he published his results in a relatively raw state and left it to the reader. It was the reader's job to cook these raw results, as it were, to interpret the categories and responses as best the reader can. So he tried, as it were, to take at least his own veil of interpretative subjectivity out of the process. And, of course, this reflects a more linguistic critique, reflecting wider issues of reference that have yielded a return to the Baudrillardian semiotic, and for some Wittgensteinian text of discourse of culture, the idea that we might have to take out the ghost in the machine and just deal with the text. So the hermeneutic gap between the inner and the outer remains. And since William James, the modern self-reflective form of the discipline is only too aware that all talk of such a core must be mediated by a science of external signs of some sort or other, whether testimonial, clinical, or cultural. The philosophies of language, whether Wittgensteinian, Saussurean, or hermeneutic, that are drawn upon to provide a hermeneutic foundation have not fully resolved the interpretive issues attendant on talking about subjective meanings. And the underlying tension remains between the positivity of modern psychological data and the hidden depths whose existence at a practical level psychoanalysts from Freud to R.D. Lang have had to acknowledge. In his own elusive language, Charles Winquist expresses the somewhat disappointed hopes for clarity facing those who study this elusive reality from a psychological perspective. He writes, "The dependence of rationality for a linguistic exfoliation in its expression subjects the subject to all the ambiguities of language in its primary metaphoricity and in its overdetermination in a venue that is not always or fully conscious." It's linguistic exfoliation. If you keep rubbing away at the subject with language, eventually you'll get something solid. But of course, the ambiguities of language cause great trouble. The subject is disseminated beyond itself in realities that are not under its control, even though the primary reference of experience remains in the notion of self as subject. And potentially there's a danger here, an actual danger of doing an ethical disservice to the subject, of obscuring the subject. The person has their internal world. Maybe they haven't successfully expressed it, but what they've been turned to by the academic is a range of different texts and discourses which can be variously interpreted. Maybe they didn't say it right. But to take the text as the subject, I think, is problematic. We certainly wouldn't always want that to be done to ourselves, as it were. Okay. And thus, you know, in a way, all of this reflects the Freudian subject, the idea that there's always, you know, he very much formalized the idea that there's a hidden sphere. And it reflects the idea that the subject who's barely rational, barely self-conscious, always remains bound and concealed by the difficulties of its expression. The Freudian subject is always, by definition, a frustrated one. Now, people have... There's a tendency to combat this problem with methodologies that focus on linguistic systems. And some have supported this. There's an interesting article in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion by Edward Slingerland called Who's Afraid of Reductionism, where he says it shouldn't necessarily be a problem to give these parallel accounts of different, you know, internal forces. We shouldn't worry. It doesn't mean that God isn't there or that the subject isn't there. But I must say, I think that he doesn't quite do justice to the situation. He suggests that psychology can be used as an explanatory tool without eliminating a wider range of explanations. But is this true, for instance, of Boyer, whose theory of religion exemplifies the restrictive and reductive tendencies of psychological explanation? Restrictive in the sense that he takes a very specific set of data, a very specific definition of religion, and reductive in the sense that he ultimately does say religious ideas come from certain clear neurological processes when they come into contact with the external world. The problems have led psychologists of religion who write as religious insiders to suggest that it's time to shift our pragmatic focus from the easily and objectively measured externals of religion, quote, to, quote, understand better what committed religious people would see as the inner core of religious experience and understanding. It's a quote from Fraser Watts. Now, just briefly, let's take one part of the critique. One major critique is the charge that the drive toward positivistic referentiality and completeness in theories, in psychological theories, is hopeless. You can suggest certain processes, but what your positing of those processes actually refers to in the mind is always going to be unclear in some ways, because the ontology of the mind is unclear, and is also going to be unverifiable to some extent. It's always going to be speculative. And the idea of completeness, that the desire, that the belief that a theory should be complete, that it should refer to something definite and be complete and not allow for data which is not explained by the system, that also seems to be problematic, because the mind tends not to be wholly regular. So in the light of these critiques, psychologists of religion have often been criticized for their overconfident reduction to simple schemes, their methodological naivety in suggesting that these schemes correspond to a cognitively nearby reality. They seem to imitate the intuitive, easy empiricism of the natural sciences. The rationalists in the study of religion can be seen as one-idea thinkers. Freud says that we displace our repressed desires, Jung that we externalize inner forces, Marx that we gain catharsis, Tyler that we misattribute agency, etc., etc. Tambia gently ridicules such thinkers as lumpers, for they try to lump every instance of religious thought into a single, simple process of rationality. Another way to see them as theorists of a complex reality, but with a naively Newtonian or Darwinian notion of what it is to be found, simple, continuous forces, or repeated mechanisms. There's a certain trend, it's a very seductive trend, I think, in science, to say, well, there must be a force, and that regularity and continuity that Newton points to is very appealing, or there must be a mechanism, and a mechanism, you know, tends to only do one thing. You never think of a mechanism as one that's completely random. And so again, you get a certain continuity and simplicity there. And these imposed standards have been reflected in the theories of many canonical religionists, working to reduce the remit of the religious and the subjective to fit within manageable boundaries. I think it's very easy when you read the classic thinkers to see them as trying to produce a manageable model that will fit into their book and which won't leave out very much. They seem too reluctant to deal with the rich pluralities and ambiguities with which a religionist must become comfortable. But the implications can be quite sinister. Echoing Jung's own concern about the misuses of psychological positivism by religion in his essay, The Individual's Understanding of Himself in The Undiscovered Self, Jeremy Corrett points to that. Jung says that psychology makes the self seem simple and clear, and religion, and indeed other social forces and authorities, then adopts that notion of the self, a self which is all sort of easily seen, easily manipulated. And Jeremy Corrett reflects this in noting that psychology captures the rich realm of subjectivity and captures it in a way that it's ready for subjugation and coercion. It sounds a lot to me like sort of post-colonial critiques, actually. If you can describe, it's a Foucauldian point, if you can describe it nicely, then you can subject it to the power of knowledge and the manipulation of knowledge. He writes, the gradual psychologization of experience and the embedding of the category of religion inside such a process in the 20th century is the rejection of an outworldly individualism found in Christianity and Judaism. It was part of the disarming of a theological knowledge of the self and related forms of introspective discourse. The psychologized subject of capitalism provided the technology for rethinking the ontology of ourselves through the acts of measurement and analysis, which closed down the liminality of the self, found in the sacrifice of the self which Foucault identified in Christian history. Again, strongly Foucauldian, this comes up again and again. As soon as you make the self quantifiable, measurable, analyzable, and, as it were, encircled by understanding, then you disempower it to some extent. And so in laying these systems and laying claim to an exhaustive clarity that is attributed to the natural sciences, take an essential, irreducible, and autonomous reality away from us, replacing it by sleight of hand with an impoverished simulacrum that is much more amenable to manipulation. Knowledge itself has many discourses, modes, and moods, and many uses too. Totalizing knowledge is an attractive but dangerous member of that family, and I want to address those who've said that try and ask psychology to be less totalizing. I won't go into details of that overconfidence as it's manifested in different thinkers. You do see it, for instance, in Freud, who marshals all the rhetorical tools of completeness and persuasion in his narrative. Freud gives a narrative not only of religious subjectivity, it's very clear, lucid, and certain tones, but he also gives a narrative of a whole wide range of civilization in his later works. And there are certain methods he uses to do this. He borrows from Darwin scientific theories, he borrows from a certain Hegelian sense that we can easily make sense of the whole of things. And all of this, you know, and he makes also use, I think, of the sense that he has special access to psychological data that at that point in time no one else really had, or that he could remain largely unchallenged by competing practitioners. And of course he uses lots of rhetorical language in his studies. I think we've prepared the way sufficiently for an answer to such and such. It has become clear now that such and such. We all know that such and such. He draws the reader along with his reasoning through a coercive and conspiratorial discourse. And actually, Boyer also does something very similar, but with slightly different rhetorical techniques. He also tries to show you his reasoning, I think more than Freud does. He shows you the reasoning that he's used to arrive at his conclusions. He describes the experiments that he's used and describes the logic by which they produce results. And in that way, he's very good, although in describing his experiments, he never describes he doesn't describe what they can't show. He never tells you what the limitations of the experiment is. And indeed, in writing a book, Religion Explained, that's for a more popular audience, I think he knows that sort of confident simplicity is going to be very persuasive. If you know Religion Explained, has all these wonderful little diagrams with little pictures of birds and different kinds of categorical concepts. And it's very good and lucid. That's why partly why it's been popular. But it's also, in its simplification, persuasive. It's also very persuasive that the evidence it's producing is simply true and sufficient for the results that he gets out of it. So like Freud, he can seem to assert his explanations without acknowledging their speculative nature. I won't go into the details. There are many, many problems one can draw with his results. Okay, now that's all kind of, we know that, in a way. The critiques, I think, are well documented, and everybody struggles with them. And there's perhaps we've reached a stalemate in the current situation, where people fundamentally have said, we know that there are methodological problems, we know that we can't verify conclusively this data, we know that there are other possible interpretations of the data, we know that the inference isn't always the best evidence for something. A generalization always means, as Jung says, that you've left out parts of the data, and that's a problem of selectivity and interpretation itself. We know that there's a lot of deduction that uses possible causes of something, but does not use necessary preconditions. So again, you know, there's a lot of kind of massaging of the evidence and the types of evidence that are used. And in the end, what does this amount to? It's all speculative. Okay, and I mean, even when you get down to the philosophy of science, everyone's ignoring Hume's critique of causality, and scientists will say, look, we have to do this. What we're doing is A, aligned with the way that we arrive at all of our everyday knowledge, and B, frankly necessary if we're going to come up with any kind of system of knowledge at all. And some people get, you know, upset about this, and some people won't. I guess the defense that I want to make, particularly of these earlier thinkers and the models that they come up with of the psyche, and also later thinkers as well, all those who come up with the model, is that actually they're doing something that, if you acknowledge its limitations, is quite reasonable. Okay. Now, the critiques of Freud, of Jung, and other thinkers are seen as are such that they critique them for being loose in their evidence and unrecognizing of their speculative assertions. And they tend to be contrasted, I think, with the more certain knowledge that you could find in good, solid empirical sciences, in the natural sciences. Right? But of course, scientific knowledge itself, in the natural sciences, empirically, seems hardier, seems stronger because its objects can be directly experienced, directly perceived in many cases, and mutually perceived with other observers, so that you can both directly observe the evidence rather than symptomatically deducing it, and you can verify it with other people. And this tends to lend a certain sense that this is a stronger source of knowledge. But both at the practical and the philosophical level, science has recognized that it too sees only symptoms of purported entities and forces. Causality is the classic scientific example. We observe its effects, and from this deduce something that gives rise to those effects. Gravity and other Newtonian forces fall under the same method of examination. We observe the effects and we deduce, or we posit. I mean, actually, it's not deduction. We posit something that gives rise to this. But Hume will remind us that this is not logically necessary, it's not shown, it's what you call a placeholder concept. It's not just causes, more abstract metaphysical concepts, it's not just forces, physical concepts. So too, this is ultimately true of all objects observed, if you take a Kantian approach to it. And they're, according to their perceptual effects on us, we draw up commonsensical or scientific models of what it is that gives rise to those effects. Even when we're just talking about my perception of this white lily in front of me, what we're still doing in the end is mapping out my perceptions, your perceptions, etc., and producing a speculative model of the thing which gives rise to it, and we call it a lily. But actually, ontologically, we haven't made any strong statements about what that is. the philosophers of science will have a big argument between realism, etc., etc. And this is partly the source of phenomenological thinking about these things. But ultimately, it's not shown. And more many people will say, yes, it's a model. We're dealing with a model. And we're happy to deal with the model. We're not making ontological claims. So in each of these cases, the thing behind the sign is only a deductive placeholder. Okay, now these imposed standards have been reflected in the theories of many canonical religionists. Hold on, put that one down. And we can go in, I won't go into deeper, much deeper analysis of how the placeholder concept is produced, but one can do this. You know, what makes us collect particular symptoms into a particular causal entity? What makes us make certain deductions based on that? Consistency of symptom is one thing. Boyer refers to epidemiology as a science that helps people to think about how you map symptoms deductively backwards into proposed causes and forces and mechanisms that result in them. And phenomenology is one of the main places in which people have tried to think about how our perceptions generate ontological concepts behind them. But of course, one has to be very careful about doing this. And indeed, many of the classic psychologists were more clear about this speculative source of their knowledge than more recent thinkers are, or indeed than their critics who criticized the sources of their knowledge have been. Jung writes, for instance, since self-knowledge is a matter of getting to know the individual facts, theories help very little in this respect. For the more a theory lays claim to universal validity, the less capable it is of doing justice to the individual facts. He's making a point here about problems of theorizing in general. Any theory based on experience is necessarily statistical, that is to say, it formulates an ideal average which abolishes all exceptions at either end of the scale and replaces them by an abstract mean. This mean is quite valid. It's perfectly fine to produce a reductive theory, a limited theory, though it need not necessarily occur in reality. We mustn't pretend that what we're dealing with is something that will actually exist. And Jung points out that in many cases, the data that you're using, this statistical mean, may never have actually happened. You throw the dice 20 times, it comes up with a range of numbers. The statistical mean of those numbers is 11. It may never have actually thrown up the number 11. Okay, and he just wants to show how much we're dealing with something that's virtual and not real. He goes on, not to put too fine a point on it, one could say that the real picture consists of nothing but exceptions to the rule, and that in consequence, absolute reality has predominantly the character of irregularity. Jung also has another section in The Undiscovered Self, and also Modern Man in Search of a Soul, where he says, the unconscious is a huge realm of mystery. We can only accept it as mystery, but what we do is deal with the manifestations on its, as it were, its nearer side. But that we must always remember that what we are doing is speculating about the forces that have given rise to, in this case, the archetypes, for instance. Jung was actually very interested, I think, in writing in detail about the methodological limitations of what he did, and for reasons that I'll come to. Freud also flags up the necessity of explanatory simplification in his model. Complex and simultaneous processes must be described simply and sequentially. And as Jung points out, the general average is stated, not the irregularities. Freud has the grace to acknowledge the ways in which his data was restricted. In his preface to the second edition of The Future of an Illusion, The Future of Illusion has this wonderful, clear, simple account of how religion is generated from our competition for resources and from the problems that arise from that competition and from the displacements that occur as a result of this. But in his preface, he says, he acknowledges that he's not been able to take into account religious experiences, the existence of which his friends have assured him, but because he has not himself experienced them, which he cannot take into account in his model. He sort of says, my friends have told me I've missed out something in religion. And if I'm an honest psychologist, I have to accept that this may be true. They tell me there's an emotional dimension, a more spiritual dimension. And I'm not going to bring it into my model because I've never experienced it. I haven't perceived it. But if I'm honest, I have to allow for that possibility, and I'm doing that by referring to it here. But of course, people don't always read the preface. And in An Outline of Psychoanalysis, the late work in which he tries to explain the subjectivity to a wide audience, he allows that his very detailed model is, in the end, a model, a hypothesis, a picture. Even William James before him saw subjectivity in terms of the same image of an unknown region from which indications arise. This great quote from James: "The further limits of our being plunge, it seems to me, into an altogether different dimension of existence from the sensible and merely understandable world. Name it mystical religion or the supernatural region, whichever you choose, yet the unseen region in question is not merely ideal, it's an important part, for it produces effects in this world. When we commune with it, work is actually done upon our finite personality, for which we are turned into new men. It's the effects, the work that it does, that we can see and that we have to make account of." In comparison to a thorough reading of Freud and people like him, other modern writers can seem frustratingly naive. And I think I said Boyer tends to hide the problems in his own account. Although he does, again, make certain methodological acknowledgements. He says, we have to account for complexity. That's one of the things he wants to say. He says, no more magic bullets, a single mechanism or a single force which will account for everything. We need to acknowledge a plural and very complex range of mechanisms, again, mechanisms, that produce religion. Daniel Dennett, I think, in a non-religious context, has also wrote a book called Freedom Evolves, in which he tries to account for free will and our feeling of free will. And again, I think he does a very good job of saying, don't look at it as a simple mechanism. Look at it as many different mechanisms, many different kinds of mechanisms that will produce many different kinds of result, that when you juxtapose them, themselves produce further kinds of result, that in the end produce something that is so complex it actually looks and feels a little bit more like our own experience of our own subjectivity. It's going to make an interesting suggestion there. So what kind of models do they produce? Freud's model varies over time, and his emphasis on instincts, it must be channeled. But he ultimately, in his concerns with satisfaction, displacement, eruption of these instincts, we have a sort of volcanic model in which forces are unstoppable, pressures build, and their release in some usually uncontrollable, often dangerous form must be expected. It's a classically systemic model in that it deals with sort of a fixed economy of forces. You can't have a force dissipate. In the end, it has to be somehow dealt with. It's well suited in many ways to the ego and the superego, but it's inadequate to the id, however, which takes on an almost supernatural cast due to its incessant and unstoppable force. It seems to deal with a fixed economy of forces, but the id is constantly upwelling. And as a result, he moves on to a slightly more developed model in later work, where he actually models the different forces within the psyche not as levels through which, as it were, almost he has a notion of a space through which forces move. It's almost a fluid dynamic model that he begins with. He also moves on to say, well, but the causality involved isn't as simple as that. We need a model almost of interacting persons. And that's where he starts to model the id as the child and the superego as the parent, and the ego is some sort of mediating nanny who's trying to deal with both sort of requirements at once. What's interesting about moving to that model is that it introduces a whole different sense of how these different forces are going to interact with each other. It's no longer Newtonian. They can have arguments, they can have misunderstandings, they can have unclarities, they can have shifts in attitude between them. And I think he in some ways allows, because he's using subjectivity as a model for his model of subjectivity, as it were, he ends up allowing for a certain, maybe opening up the system a little bit. You can't always say what the id's going to do. You can't always say how the ego's going to try and respond or what the superego's going to say. It's kind of interesting that he moves in that direction in his later work. And in some ways I think this is not completely unrelated to Jung's model. Jung adopts neither a person's forces nor a computational machine model. His idea of a volcanic a volcanic model of looking at these things with its fluid dynamic or forces building fixed economy idea gives way to a kind of an oceanic model of powerful but unpredictable entities from which bubbles, shadows, and reflections rise sometimes to the surface, giving us an indication from below. There's some of the forces model that you find in Freud. The unconscious has forces that in the end will, as it were, erupt into manifestations. The notion of tensions building is still there within Jung. But they're not fixed in their economy in quite the same way. They're not predictable in quite the same physics model of a fluid dynamics. And what they produce are not simply, they don't manifest on the outside simply as forces, but as symbols, which means that their causality is again different. They're not simply going to force you to do something. What they're going to give you is something which promotes, as it were, further thought of some kind, emotional, conceptual, whatever, imaginative or whatever. So again, he's produced a model with causal relations. That's really what a model maps, but there are different kinds of causality resulting. So there are forces at work. There is a person's element here. The oceanic model includes conscious sailors on the surface who chart the winds around them and the currents beneath, it's kind of the ego. And there are forces at work in the unconscious, this is sure. But those forces send signs of events from an unknown region that echoes James's image. And these are events the nature of which we can know nothing. He's very clear about this. We don't know what sea monster it is on the bed of the ocean that sent up this, shoal of fish or this particular sign that we get at the surface. We can't know, and we need to know and accept that we can't know. Jung is, in a sense, more Kantian. Something has caused the sign, the dream, the emotion, the fantasy, but we cannot know how that causality acts. It's not a forces model. We don't even know how it sent the sign, intentionally or not, and thus can know nothing of the nature of the source. Yet, and here is Jung's own unique optimism, we must interact with and in some way understand this unknowable thing. Again, we see a deep insight into aspects of some kinds of religious experience. Jung knows what it means for people to spend a life interacting at the level of existentially ultimate concerns for their own well-being with a causal agency that could be God or it could be the self that they can never directly know or fully predict, map or picture to themselves. In a way, he knows that this is very similar. Just as the self is an unknown force with huge amount of power over us, of which we can't even get a complete idea by definition, we cannot consciously model this entity, so the same thing applies in a sense to God. It's powerful, but ultimately unknowable and indeed unpredictable. Okay, so where these models have been criticized for their oversimplicity, we can now understand them better in the light of their unspoken limitations and their practical goals. and each one, I haven't done this here, but each one can be gone through hermeneutically to say exactly which aspects of psychological symptoms are they modeling? What does their particular model of causality show us? And that could be not only predicting what's going to happen, but showing us ways in which we have to interact with the self, as it were, with the subjectivity that we cannot see. Is it just that we have to mediate the force that it produces? Or is it that we have to read the signs? Or whatever. The last point I want to make is that the great challenge that seems left over is to incorporate this element of mystery into a model. It's a wider issue that we find in the sciences. The sciences, in its explanatory, in its notion of explanation, in its notion of systemic explanation, it seems to have trouble with acknowledging that data which they can't account for. Trouble, and not just, what they do is they'll say, and then there was some data we can't account for. How would you take that data and actually incorporate it into the model of knowledge rather than simply say, and here's something that's on the outside? I.e., a map must let you know what it does not indicate. Only then is it safe. An absence of elevation, for instance, in a map of the Alps may be very misleading. How can one systematize the lack of data, the unpredictability of results, and indeed the very premise that the map describes our experiences in the landscape, not the landscape itself? i.e. remind ourselves that the model is a model of symptoms of what we may encounter and not necessarily a model of subjectivity itself. How can science incorporate mystery? In some respects, what must go if we're to incorporate mystery is the principle that acts as a check on the process of system building, Occam's razor. The idea that the simplest explanation that draws on the fewest speculative extravagances is the one that we must choose is the glue for any hypothesis. Otherwise, you come up with a crazy, crazy range of accounts for something happening. It stops postulates from flying apart in a free-for-all of causal possibilities, but it also hides the fact of our speculative choice between multiple explanations and the inherent drive towards simplification. Other approaches reject this chaotic partiality and provisionality of the psychology of religion, taking it as a sign that the psychology of religion is inherently flawed. If you admit the problems, it suggests that it's inherently flawed. And Winquist concludes that the legacy of Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud's hermeneutics of suspicion should remind us that we can accept those limitations. It's the discovery that, quote, incompleteness, undecidability, indeterminacy, contingency, relativity, and the overdetermination of meaning are terms that can be more easily indexed to the reflexivity of conscious thinking about its use of language through the medium of language than can clarity, distinctness, and univocity. It's his description of, you know, that's what's simply going to happen when conscious thinks about what it says and indeed what it thinks. Thus, psychology has also been suggested as the battleground where the self as subjectivity must finally be relinquished. Well, just briefly, I want to look at how Jung, Freud, and Jung particularly, and R.D. Lang and Jeremy Caret have tried to propose what Bruce Maslisch calls an uncertain science, and psychology is just that. Jung has indeed tried to do this. The Jungian subject never aspires to complete unmediated clarity. And Jung indeed argued that mystery can be beneficial, even a form of knowledge itself and a practical medium for functioning effectively in the world. He says, actually, if you look at how we deal with knowledge at an everyday level, mystery is an important and valuable part of that. He writes that, our psyche is part of nature and its enigma is as limitless. Thus, we cannot define either the psyche or nature. We can only state what we believe them to be and describe as best we can how they function. He defends the courage to embrace this problem as the mark of civilization in the progressive sense of a maturation of consciousness. Quote, the artful denial of a problem will not produce conviction. When we must deal with problems, we instinctively resist trying the way that leads through obscurity and darkness. We wish to hear only of unequivocal results, and to completely forget that these results can only be brought about when we have ventured into and emerged again from the darkness. A sense of venturing into mystery and knowing when we come out of it the very status of what the material that we've emerged with. Elsewhere, Jung gives wonderful quotes where he says that this acknowledgement of mystery is both what we need to have as mature and happy, healthy modern people, and indeed it's a part of religion. It's what makes the religious person, or the religionist, a good psychologist. So he writes, religion in the sense of conscientious regard for the irrational factors of the psyche and individual fate is our future, is a good thing towards which we aspire. Just two more sets of quotes. Robert Lang is little recognized, but very important in this regard. He's very popular in the 70s. He gave sort of thorough critiques of modern family and the sort of power structures of control involved in the modern family. But before this, he actually wrote more explicitly on schizophrenia and in a book called The Divided Self. He also reminds us, as Jung does, that the unsystematizable allows for unknown causes. The wide realm of unknown causes, for which the divine is only one particular name. So unknown causes in general is something that is part of, is already part of the idea of God. But he says this is a wider issue. He saw individual experience as the stage for a profound opening of both instinct and transcendence in subjects who will not be restricted by society's demands for completeness and clarity. So again, like Foucault, he's seeing sort of a political, social, and ethical implication. If academic work cannot admit such openings and challenges, then it is in danger of conspiring with society's purported panoptical and repressive aspirations. Lang acknowledges the hermeneutic issue in psychology. He has a nice quote where he says, "Man can seen as a person or a thing." And if you are sitting opposite me, I can see you as another person like myself, or I can see you as a complex physical chemical system. Seen in this way, you're no longer a person, but an organism. Man seen as an organism and man seen as a person disclose quite different aspects of the human reality to the investigator. In some ways, it's a suggestion that ought to be put to Pascal Boyer, who seems to see the physical chemical system as adequate for dealing with all of the issues. And Lang, a bit like Slingerland, says that actually there are different discourses that can be encountered here. But more importantly, Lang, in his study of madness, looks at madness as an expression of non-system. He writes, "Madness need not all be breakdown. It may also be breakthrough. I am aware that the man who is said to be deluded may in his delusion be telling me the truth, and that this in no equivocal or metaphorical sense, but really quite literally, and that the cracked mind of the schizophrenic may let in light which does not enter the intact minds of many sane people whose minds are closed." Jeremy Corette has also acknowledged this as a defense against what he calls the epistemological takeover of experience. He argues for a psychology of not knowing that does not aspire to eliminate uncertainty, irregularity, or that which is accessible or ineffable. We must reclaim the paradox, quote from him, paradox construction or non-essentialism of self found in more ancient forms of introspection from the effect of sort of the scientific positivism. Like Jung, Lang believes that allowing such openness in our knowledge promises ethical benefits, and he suggests that the human sciences need to, quote, return to the ethical practice of living at the interface of knowing and not knowing, between given reality and philosophical assumption, between essence and construction. The desire to know limits us to the measurable and prevents us from realizing that we are always more than we imagine, more than we can measure, more than we can capture in our languages and patterns of evaluation. Knowledge is always leaking across its artificial boundaries. Western thought is always in danger of explaining human beings in terms of the known order of domination, rather than respecting the unknown, and in doing so it feeds the totalitarian impulses to control life. So mostly ending with Carrot's quote there, part of what I wanted to argue is that if you see psychological accounts of the self in their correct epistemological context, not as descriptions of subjectivity, but of models of the causal forces that yield the symptoms that we see on the outside, as maps in a sense, then they can be hugely useful. But they will always be subject to methodological critiques that makes them seem invalid until we actually acknowledge exactly what the status, what their status is, and exactly what they do tell us. And in many cases, the people who produce them have been aware of this. But I've also tried to say that while these are useful accounts of subjectivity, maybe they don't say as much as they originally seem to do. No one's going to tell us what the subjectivity is and exactly what it looks like. That's not possible, and we'll have to give that up. But we have useful tools. We also, to make them really useful, have to incorporate that which is not knowable. And not just incorporate it, but in a deeper sense, in terms of what our idea of knowledge is, become comfortable with that which is not knowable. Otherwise, we'll always turn away from this very limited model and say, oh no, that's no good. I want something that's more complete and more certain. Right? And that's going to be a problem, because subjectivity, tried to sort of suggest in the introduction, all these critiques, by definition, will not be comprehensively mappable in that way. But we have to learn that that's not what we're asking for. Right. And in a sense, maybe there are certain practical benefits that we're looking for here in the psychology of religion, just as there were in the anthropology of religion, where we're transforming selves as a real life result at the end of the process, which maybe has something to do with what religion is about in the first place. Transformation in one case, and living with important causally effective mysteries in the other. Okay, that's all I have to say for now. Okay. If anyone has any questions, please say.
Yeah, I've got one.
Go for it.
Very interesting. I was just interested in the model of psychology and psychology of religion. Mm. Is it really useful tools that need to be comfortable in the face of the not knowable?
Mm-hmm.
But there is quite a difference between saying something that claims to be a kind of an empirical science, admitting that its knowledge is perhaps always a fragment and doesn't sort of know its own completion.
Mm.
So it's not just that it's provisional, but it also sort of more broadly sort of realizing its own fragmentariness. It's quite though a step from that to acknowledging this mystery, which even came in with a capital M on your handout.
Yeah, I have a bad habit of
and,
capital M.
And I'm wondering how what big change to the model of empirical science that is, and whether empirical science could do that on its own, whether the boundary between, I suppose, psychology is a sort of social empirical science, and then some other humanistic hermeneutical study that would, you know, talk about understanding rather than knowledge or something.
Mm.
And I just wonder whether I'm sort of interested in what Dave's going to say as well.
If I get where you're coming from, I think that's a good point. I think that.
Because I think Richard Dawkins was here, he would huff and puff at the idea that scientists ought to acknowledge mystery. Because scientists just know they don't know some things yet. And they're quite happy with not knowing, so they know they'll never know everything finally or completely.
Absolutely. So then what I'm trying to say, I guess, is the difference between the scientist and the philosopher of science is that the scientist acknowledges what he doesn't know in terms of provisionality, i.e. we'll get there later. The philosopher of science, I mean, that's a generalisation.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to sort of draw
two different ways
of doing it. Whereas the philosopher of science will say, it's not just that there are some things you don't know yet, there are some things you can never know by definition. Okay, and actually, because what you're doing, the whole point of empirical science is that you're observing events.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now as Hume says, there's not much more you can say for sure than that. In fact, you know, for a philosopher of science, the whole of science is a wacky speculation that ignores Hume. What does Newton do when he says gravity's there? He notes some events, and he then says a thing which would explain them.
Mm-hmm.
Is if there's a consistent force that, by some mysterious mechanism called causality, leads to them,
mm-hmm.
right? And let's posit such a force, although we don't really know what we mean by that exactly, where it would come from, what the ontological nature of it is exactly. I mean, the whole of, you know, Newtonian physics is ontologically very unsubstantiated, just not explained. But if we do that, it's what we call a placeholder concept, then that's extremely useful. Okay, it helps us to predict. How is it useful? It helps us to predict what's going on more clearly and gives us just a mental way of thinking about the regularity of certain events in relation to certain other events. Okay, but still what we're doing in the end is a speculation, right? And at a strict philosophical level, that seems to be right. Now, the old school scientist will say, oh, for goodness sake, of course there are forces and they're objectively existing, blah, blah, blahs. But the more subtle modern scientist will say, oh yeah, of course, that's fine, that's right. We don't really know what it is that we're talking about with a force. We haven't asked any metaphysical questions here. We're using the words to talk about certain results. And this whole thing is an edifice of speculation that's perfectly fine. That's what it's always been. That's perfectly valid and there's no problem there. And of course the Kantian would make a similar message. You know, I'd say, well, we all perceive the lily.
Okay, so the mystery is the ontological mystery behind the placeholder concepts.
Yeah,
I mean, it's that science doesn't pretend to do that. This methodical method of knowing doesn't pretend to do ontology. Doesn't pretend to.
But yeah, exactly. The mystery is all those different spheres in which you have to accept that you're dealing with manifestations, events, as it were, symptoms that seem to suggest something that caused them because of their consistency and continuity. And therefore you posit something which is a general principle of causality, which is the definition of a force. Jung has a detailed discussion of this. It's quite interesting. Hempel, they're various, you know, theorists of science. And that's what a force is. It's actually just a general causal explanation. We don't even really know what we mean by force. We just mean something that keeps making these things happen. And that model results. There are various different kinds of quote-unquote mystery, things which we by definition can't actually talk about in and of themselves. And I'm suggesting that subjectivity is one of them, like maybe the thing in itself, maybe causality and forces, maybe subjectivity, i.e. levels of the self that are hidden to consciousness and can never be directly, immediately perceived. We can only get kind of effects that they, if they're there, seem to have, i.e. we get effects and we try and account for them in the self. And that's fine, but it's like those other kinds of science where you're charting the results, the effects. And that's fine. And you can then produce a placeholder concept based on those effects. You just shouldn't get... shouldn't get metaphysical about it. B, you shouldn't get totalitarian about the knowledge that you think you've arrived at.
So there's a question that arises... Sorry, I won't...
No, it's useful.
So the question that arises in empirical psychology,
mm-hmm.
Is only a kind of... sharpened because of its particular location is a sharpened version of what's there in all empirical science. There's a certain sharpening that it becomes quite important to recognise this because of the particular dangers that possibly are attendant upon psychology.
Because it's due to the person.
Because it's due to the person, because it, because it, you can sort of do most science without really bothering about this limit. You know, the philosophers of science can go on about it, but it doesn't make very much difference to anything.
Mm-hmm.
But possibly in empirical
psychology. Maybe it's more important in that way. And also it has come to light more immediately because things out here, quote-unquote, are verifiable by multiple perceivers. The problem with subjectivity, and this is always the problem everyone has, is that I can't look into Richard's head, you know. And actually, it says Jung and Freud, Richard can't even look all the way into Richard's head, you know. But we get results in Richard's consciousness that suggests that there's more going on than just what we see in his consciousness, right? So we have to look for causal forces that result in what's happening in his consciousness, which means that we create placeholder concepts like the unconscious, like the id, like, you know, his drive toward eros or whatever. And that's fine. But again, we need to know what we're doing here. It's particularly important in psychology because what's happened is we get all these models and each one is limited and restricted and people say that doesn't account for anything or for everything. Or it's highly speculative and people say, where did you get this from? You know, you just come up with this model. And people then are inclined to throw these models out. Whereas actually they're just doing what all the other scientists are doing. But we just see more clearly their restricted and speculative nature. If we acknowledge, you know, they're necessary limitations, we can actually be a little bit more positive about them in some ways. But also we won't make quite the same extravagant claims in some ways. Maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
Anything else? Tear it apart.
Well, no, I wasn't going to tear it apart at all. I was going to make a comment. I quite like the idea of a map, which is... kind of like a journey across an unknown terrain, and the expression you used was prediction of certain encounters that one might have,
mm-hmm.
and I had the image of a milestone on one's journey.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is if one describes such a milestone to someone who hasn't yet passed it, it might have either a promoting or an inhibiting effect on that person. So I think in a sense, such descriptions kind of influence one way or another the reader.
Yeah.
That's one thing. So it isn't. Yeah. It hasn't got the kind of studied objectivity that a scientific paper would have.
Mm-hmm.
So I think writing's about. And it would argue, I think, for almost the disciplines being in sort of watertight compartments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not happy with that idea, but that certainly would push it in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, the other point I was going to make is, I wonder, going back to the kind of, you know, the so-called objective anthropologist, whether it might be possible, even in theory, to enter simultaneously entertain multiple viewpoints, or whether there's some kind of gestalt operating, where you either you're in one paradigm or another, and whether one can flip between one and another, and if so, how that happens. And I'm thinking in religious context, I'm thinking of like a conversion experience, and maybe even a deconversion experience, a sort of flexibility of being able to move from one whole world view to another. And I'm not sure that's possible. And this is something I mentioned the other day, Brian. I think there's something about the sociality of it, if that's the right word, that involves a concept of a sense of belonging. And I think that's pretty kind of central to religious practice and ideas. And I don't know where that would fit within a kind of, you know, this idealised anthropologist, where they would sit in that. Especially with a guy who took 20 years to kind of suss out where he was, what happened to him or whatever it was.
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting point. So just the first point first about the maps influencing people's expectations, I think that's very true. So again, it's one of the things that we have to remember, one of the reasons why we have to remember that it's a map or a model and not a description of exactly what's there in reality.
Yes, that's a good point. I mean, I think a lot of people take the map itself, you know, the sacred text, to be sacred themselves rather than just a liturgical tool to get you somewhere else.
Yeah, it has a theological implication for this metaphor of this.
Exactly. And they say that, you know, religions get ossified because it's people that haven't got the experience, they take the signifiers to be the reality.
Yeah, and in psychology, there's a danger of saying, oh, how Freud described me, that's what's going on in me, and that's problematic. It's a model. There's also a danger, you know, similarly maybe a Jungian would say, oh yeah, my dream, that's really telling me what's inside. I mean, Jung makes it clear that the dream isn't a determinate sign in a regular way. I think that's a valuable and useful thing that he a way in which he tries to moderate the apparent determinism of parts of Freud's model. You know, that you have to be careful. It's not always consistent and regular, and you have to respect some of that. It just kind of raises that. I might argue, I think, though, that some of that is also true in the natural sciences. You know, this is Kuhn and Feyerabend, you know, you get used to a certain paradigm, and you may get irregularities that you don't know how to interpret because you're so used to one model.
The person expounding it is got a very great influence how well it's accepted.
Yeah, and Einstein, you know, often these people, the paradigm shifters, will talk about creativity, you know, of shifting a new model. But again, they're models. So it can also influence people. As a philosopher, I find this when I have debates with realists and non-realists, it's very hard for one group to see the other model because they just can't. Their interpretative way of seeing the data is already being determined, and it's very hard to make that shift. So it's an interesting, useful point. The thing about, we talk about the flexibility of the subject in anthropology. Yeah, the commonality and belonging, and it's hard to flip between different ones. I personally, from my own experience and the experience of people around me, I actually think it's surprisingly easy once people leave home. Oxford is full of people who no longer have a home. I just bought a coffee from a guy who was born in Palestine, moved to Kuwait, spent a lot of time in South Africa, now is in England, was in Spain, and wants to go to America. And I feel like I'm between different cultures. And more, you know, kids whose parents have just come from India or from Egypt and now are mediating very different ways, different cultural tones, different ethoses, different ethics, different religious views, but do flip between them, actually, all the time. That's why I said in that paper, I think that view of belonging is important, terribly important, and all that Clifford Geertz says about worldviews, all that D.Z. Phillips says about the picture that determines how you see things, is important. Maybe what we do is create kind of mediating, intermediary worlds that we ourselves live in. But I actually think that people do manage to flip. And whenever I teach world religions, for instance, I know that I've succeeded in a class when a kid says, oh, I used to think that Islamic law was all about this, but now I see it in a whole different light, with a different feeling. I see it as positive. I see it as, you know, involving these kinds of qualities, and I couldn't even see it that way before. So I know what you mean. I think that's an important part of describing what a worldview involves, but I do actually think that it is flexible, and that's one of the points of using literature as actually an example of how, in an everyday context, we enjoy putting our subjectivity somewhere else.
It's a very kind of creative space to be in, actually.
It can be. I mean, I'm being a bit... one of my best friends argues with this, and he's like, I don't feel as flexible as you do. And, you know, and you're extrapolating from your own experience, which I guess is what we do. That's my model. But I think there is more possibility for it. Maybe it's just because I like the idea. Anything else?
Thank you for that.